The little Libyan was lying face down on the floor in the bedroom. Halim's flex cuffs, which had secured him to the chair, had been cut away and a new set put on. An additional pair had been doubled up and pulled extra tight as a tourniquet to reduce the blood flow to his injured hand. The blood from his broken nose had slowed to a trickle. Each man had been gagged with a piece of duct tape.
"We all good to go here?" Harvath asked as he stepped into the room.
Morrison and Barton flashed him the thumbs up. Removing two hoods from his pocket, Harvath placed one over each of the prisoners' heads and gave the command to move out. By the time they stepped outside, Stalen and Haney were already in the courtyard, engines running, doors open. While Morrison and Barton loaded the two Libyans into the cargo area of the land cruiser, Harvath laid a map out on the hood and illuminated it. According to the NSA and the drone team, militia fighters were headed toward them from all directions. The only way to avoid contact was to stay off the main paved roads. Crisscrossing the desert was a series of dirt roads predominantly used by local farmers. They'd be tough as hell to follow, but Harvath had a plan. Quickly indicating the route he wanted to take, he told everybody to mount up, and then he let the drone team know they were rolling. Outside the gates, they slowed only long enough for Haney to pick up Gage and then put the pedal to the metal. They were going to punch right through the center of the trap. There was only one way it could go wrong. Chapter 28. Washington, D.C. The woman looked at him as if he was crazy.
"You want me to put a full package on Lydia Ryan? The deputy fucking director of the CIA. Are you nuts?"
"Keep your voice down," Andrew Jordan cautioned. They were sitting at a small table in the back of the oldest bar and restaurant in town, the Old Ebbett Grill. It was a popular spot for D.C. power players, just a stone's throw from the White House. And while Andrew Jordan didn't look it, he definitely considered himself a power player. He was the hidden force behind Page Partners Limited. Without him, Paul Page would be nothing and would have nothing. But unlike Paul, he had to keep a low profile. Every penny he made from his share of Page Partners Limited was deposited into offshore accounts. From there, it flowed into a series of shell corporations that invested in real estate and various foreign business ventures. All of it stayed outside the United States, beyond the prying eyes of his employer, the Central Intelligence Agency. Nothing triggered an investigation faster than a report that you were believed to be living beyond your means. To avoid getting flagged, he was extremely judicious with everything. He maxed out his retirement plans, had a mortgage below what he qualified for, drove a pre-driven car, vacationed modestly, and contributed generously to a handful of charities. He had no vices, save one. From time to time, he liked to go out for a good meal. This time, it was dinner at the Old Ebbett. With him was a contractor who did a lot of off-the-books work for the Central Intelligence Agency. Unless someone from the Directorate of Operations had walked in, no one in the restaurant would have recognized either of them. And even then, it was highly unlikely they would have recognized the contractor. She was a discreet source whom Jordan had spent a lot of time quietly developing. The woman's name was Susan Viskovich. She had been in Army Intelligence, then the NSA, and eventually had gone out on her own. She was in her late 30s, but took very good care of herself and looked 10 years younger. She had long blonde hair, which tonight she wore up in a tight bun. This was business. And from what she had just been told, it was dangerous business. Leaning over the table, she lowered her voice and asked,
"Why the hell would you want a full electronic surveillance package on Ryan?"
"I'm not at liberty to discuss that," he replied. Picking up her wine glass, she leaned back in her chair and said, "Find somebody else."
"There is nobody else. You're the best."
Viskovich took a sip of her wine but remained silent. She didn't want this job. No good would come of it.
"I'm willing to double your fee."
"I'll bet you are," she replied. Holding up her glass to get their server's attention, she signaled that she was ready for another one. You? He nodded, and Viskovich motioned for a full round. There were a dozen large oysters in front of them. She chose one and added some mignonette sauce. Then she raised the shell to her mouth, tipped her head back, and let it slide down her throat. Jordan watched, his appreciation for how she consumed her oysters a bit too obvious.
Is there a problem? She asked.
No, I was just thinking.
I know what you were thinking. Knock it off.
He held up his hands.
This is just business. That's all this is.
You're damn right that's all this is. Reaching down, she prepared another oyster and was about to eat it when she set it back onto her plate. I understand why I get the kinds of jobs I do from you. It's not necessarily because they're hard, though most of them are, but rather because if I get caught, the agency can deny any knowledge of me.
Correct.
And I'm okay with that, she stated. But this is different. Why does the agency want to run covert surveillance on its own deputy DCI?
I told you, it's...
She raised her hand and cut him off. Don't bullshit me, Andy. Not if you seriously want me to consider this job. And if that's what you want, you must have come here knowing that I'd expect an explanation.
He saw their waiter approaching and waited until he had set the drinks on the table and had walked away before responding.
Ryan is leaving the agency.
Interesting, she replied, pouring what was left of her wine into the new glass and then taking a sip. What do you care?
Have you heard of the Carlton Group?
Viskovich smiled.
Everybody worth their salt in our game has heard of the Carlton Group.
That's where she's going.
Again, why do you care?
Jordan loaded up an oyster with horseradish and cocktail sauce.
Because she's not going alone. She's going to be taking key people with her.
Is that a crime?
It depends.
Then why not bring in the FBI?
It's tricky, he said, as he raised the overloaded oyster to his mouth, slurped it back, and continued to talk as he chewed. Ryan may be sharing some things with her new employer that neither they nor the FBI should be hearing.
Viskovich ignored the man's poor table manners and redirected. So, use your own people to surveil her.
Therein lies our problem. Lydia Ryan has been at CIA a long time. Everybody likes her. She's got friends everywhere. We can't do this internally.
It sounds like you've got a pretty serious problem.
Tell me about it.
Taking another sip, she swirled the wine in her glass and asked, Who knows about your investigation?
It's a tight circle, he said, as he loaded up another oyster. And needless to say, none of what we have discussed here goes any further.
Viskovich rolled her eyes. Give me a break. I know how this works. Is the director involved?
Without missing a beat, Jordan looked up from his oyster, smiled at her, and lied.
DCI McGee? Of course. He's running the entire investigation, 100%.
Good. From what I hear, he's a reasonable man. He'll understand I expect you to triple my fee.
Jordan squinted at her.
And, she added, I want an official finding, signed by the director, on his letterhead, authorizing me to do what you're asking.
He shook his head. No way. He'll never go for it.
Those are my terms. You either meet them, or I walk.
For several moments, he pretended to think about her demands. Finally, he said,
I think I can probably get McGee to agree to that. But for triple your fee, it's going to need to include another surveillance package.
That depends. Who's the target?
Ryan's new boss, said Jordan. Reed Carlton.
Chapter 29. Libya. Completely blacked out, Harvath's two-vehicle convoy pounded through the desert, using their night vision goggles to guide them. Night vision goggles, though, depended on ambient light, something they had too little of. Usually on an operation like this, the vehicles would have been outfitted with infrared headlights or some other sort of IR.
But this wasn't a normal operation, and Harvath had known that even under the best of conditions, the dirt roads were going to be tough to follow. Fortunately, he had come up with a solution. Keying up his radio, he had asked the drone team to sparkle the roads for him. On board the Reaper was a powerful infrared laser that acted like a giant laser pointer. It not only helped illuminate their route, but it also helped direct them where they needed to go. Light on the infrared spectrum was invisible to the naked eye and can only be seen with night vision. It was a very useful tool, which gave them an exceptional advantage. The advantage, however, was short-lived. Harvath's plan had been to stay on the desert roads until just south of the tiny fishing village of Abu Kamash, not far from the Tunisian border. There, provided no one was on their tail, they could cut back south along the coast and pick up the road that would take them back to the safe house. That plan was scrapped when the drone team alerted Harvath that his convoy had vehicles converging on it from multiple directions.
How the hell was that possible?
Off sparkle, he ordered.
Roger that, off sparkle, the drone team leader replied. The effect was like someone turning off a streetlight. Their visibility instantly dropped. Stalin, who was piloting their land cruiser, had no choice but to slow down. They went from doing more than 60 miles an hour to less than 20. Harvath, who was riding shotgun, leaned forward to get a better view through the windshield, but it was no use. Behind them, Haney slowed the technical. Compared to how fast they had been going, they were now moving at a snail's pace.
What are the hostile vehicles doing now?
Harvath asked over the radio.
Same thing you are, the voice replied.
Harvath had been afraid of that. It looked as if they had night vision as well. It was the weak spot in his plan. And while he couldn't know for sure how the Libya Liberation Front had gotten their hands on such highly restricted technology, he had a pretty good idea. A few years ago, American Special Forces soldiers had set up a secret training camp on an old military base in this part of Libya. It was called Camp 27 because it was at the 27-kilometer marker on the road from Tripoli to Tunis. Its goal was to help train up a team of 100 high-speed Libyan counterterrorism fighters. The United States had provided them with Glock pistols, M4 rifles, and other essential equipment, including night vision goggles. Several months later, when no U.S. personnel were present, two local militias and a jihadist group sympathetic to Al-Qaeda overran the camp. None of the American-supplied gear was ever seen again. Harvath was willing to bet that the night vision the militia was using, as well as the three Glocks he had taken off the dead militia members at the electronics shop in Al-Jamil, were from Camp 27. Not that any of that information was of any help to him. Right now, they had to shake those vehicles that were barreling down on them. Speaking with the drone team leader, Harvath said,
"Can you turn the sparkle back on and lead them in a different direction?"
"Roger that. But are you sure you want us to leave you blind?"
"If you can get those guys off our ass, it'll be a fair trade-off."
"Copy that," the drone team leader replied. "Adjusting course."
Moments later, he added, "Sparkle in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Sparkle engaged."
Without the powerful IR laser helping to guide them, trying to make it all the way back via the desert would take hours. They were going to have to risk a shortcut. Harvath studied his map. They were just outside the town of Zeltan. If they could get to the other side, they could pick up the coastal road and be home free.
"Let's pull over here," he said to Stalin.
Behind them, Haney also pulled to the side of the road. The dome lights had been deactivated, but nevertheless, Harvath double-checked before opening his door. It felt good to get out of the car and stretch his legs. Morrison and Barton hopped out too, but stayed near the rear of the SUV to keep an eye on their two Libyan prisoners. When Harvath walked back to the technical, Haney was standing next to it taking a piss. Gage was busy packing a new wad of chaw into his mouth. "When we get back to the house," the Green Beret said, "I'm ordering in pizza and a six-pack."
"Fuck that," Haney replied. "We're getting Chinese. And then we're going to the Holiday Inn up the street. I hear they got an awesome cover band, Bomb Jovi."
Harvath couldn't help but laugh. Next to the action, one of the biggest things he missed when he was back home was the sense of humor so many operators had.
"Here's where I'm at," he said. "Using the IR from the drone is no longer an option. But without it, going the back roads under NVGs will take us all night. Even so, we can flip our headlights back on and press our luck through the desert. Maybe some farmer sees us and calls it into the bad guys, maybe he doesn't. Or, we can cut through this town up ahead, roll for the coast, and be drinking Mai Tais in under an hour. Thoughts?"
"Frankly," said Gage, "I think Mai Tais are elitist, but I like the idea of being home in under an hour. I say cut through town." Harvath looked at Haney. While he respected everyone on the team, his was the opinion he valued the most. "A lot more eyeballs and cell phones in town," he said, rubbing the stubble along his jaw. "Much higher potential for being spotted, even at 4 in the morning.
"True.
We don't know what we're riding into. There could be some leave-behinds. Who knows if every militia member saddled up and rode out. All it takes is one guy in a window or on a rooftop, and we're screwed." Harvath was about to respond when Stalin walked up.
"Bad news," the Delta Force operative said.
"What is it?"
"We are starting to run low on fuel. There isn't enough to bounce all over hell and back."
"But there's an extra 2,
Harvath began, then caught himself. They had used the extra cans of fuel to burn down the electronics shop.
"Fuck."
"Yep," Stalin replied. "Exactly."
"So we've got no choice."
"Not unless you brought a siphon with you and want to suck the gas out of the technical."
There was some surgical tubing in the med kit, but nowhere near enough.
"We could cut the fuel line or puncture the tank, put something underneath it to catch everything."
"Oh, that sounds like fun," Stalin replied as he turned and walked away. "If you need me, I'll be in the Land Cruiser."
Harvath turned back to Haney and Gage.
"What do you think?"
"I think it's late," said Gage, "and anyone with any sense in that town is asleep. We kafia up, we roll hard and fast, and nobody's the wiser."
"Mike, what do you think?" asked Harvath.
Even though he was the leader, it was important to get buy-in from the entire team.
"I think there's no good answer. That's what I think."
"So is that a yes or a no?"
Haney thought about it for a moment and then looked at him.
"I don't want to miss Bomb Jovi, so I guess it's a yes."
Harvath smiled and turned to follow Stalin back to the SUV. As he was walking away, Gage imitated a goat and sang,
"You give love a bad name."
Back at the Land Cruiser, he spoke with Barton and Morrison. They both agreed with the plan, especially in light of the fuel situation. Neither wanted to court trouble, but they couldn't see a way around it either. All things considered, it seemed worth the risk. Climbing back into the vehicle, Harvath double-checked his map, and after a final check with the drone team that their ruse had worked and the Sparkle was leading the militia vehicles away, he gave the order to get moving. This was either going to be one of his best or one of his worst ideas ever. Only time would tell. As Stalin got back onto the road and started rolling, Harvath looked at his watch. There wasn't much darkness left. Quietly, he said a little prayer. All he asked was that they be allowed to get back to the safe house without any problems. But something had attached itself to his vehicle. A little something called Murphy. Chapter 30. Zeltan was cut in half by the east-west road that ran to the border with Tunisia. The most densely populated neighborhoods were south of the road, and as luck would have it, that was the direction from which Harvath and his team were approaching. The road they needed to get to, which would take them to the coast, was on the north side of town. The fastest and most direct route would have been to travel right through the center of Zeltan. It would have also drawn the most attention. The dawn prayer, known as the Fajr, was only an hour away. There were going to be people making their way to local mosques. Harvath decided to trade a little expediency for some added safety. They would loop around the west side of town to avoid as much as possible. The road system, though, was medieval. Narrow, dusty streets
sometimes ran for only a couple of blocks before looping back on themselves or dead-ending. It reminded Harvath of the maze of streets on the Greek island of Mykonos, designed to disorient pirates. It was going to be a nightmare getting through. They took their NVGs off and turned their headlights on. With their keffiyehs helping to disguise them, they moved quickly around the southern edge of the town. If Zeltan was a watch face, they were at about the 8 o'clock position when Haney radioed that they had someone on their tail.
"Everyone stay cool," said Harvath,
as he instructed Stalin to make the next right turn.
"Let's see if this is for real."
The land cruiser made the turn, followed by the technical. It was one of the neighborhoods Harvath had wanted to avoid. The houses, pockmarked and scarred from fighting during the revolution, were packed tightly together. Some were in better shape than others. Parked cars lined the street. Electric lines were strung from one building to the next. There was no movement. It was quiet. Very quiet.
"He's still behind us," said Haney.
"Roger that,"
Harvath replied. Turning to Stalin, he said,
"Take the next right."
The Delta Force operative obeyed, and they headed down another crowded block of homes.
"How are we looking now, Haney?"
Harvath asked, as he tried to get a good view with his side mirror.
"Not good. Still on my six."
Pointing out the windshield, Harvath told Stalin,
"Take this next turn up ahead,"
and repeated the same to Haney over the radio.
"Roger that,"
they both replied. As soon as they had made the turn, Harvath said,
"Now floor it."
The big SUV's engine roared as it rocketed down the street, this one paved and complete with intermittent streetlights. Looking in his side mirror, he was finally able to see the vehicle tailing Haney. It was another technical. Either this guy had just gotten lucky, or somewhere someone had spotted them and had called it in. It didn't make a difference now. They needed to lose him.
3 o'clock,
Barton exclaimed from the back seat. Harvath swiveled his head to the right. Paralleling them one road over was an additional technical. Fuck.
"Make sure they don't box us in," he told Stalin.
The Delta Force operative nodded.
"What do you want to do?"
He wanted to get the hell out of there, but with two tails and more likely inbound, that was impossible. He had to come up with an alternative plan, fast. Keying up his radio, he announced to Stalin and Haney,
"Left turn up ahead, then the second right."
When the men acknowledged the directions, Harvath turned to Barton.
"Hand me that Russian grenade launcher."
Once he did, Harvath double-checked to make sure it was loaded, and then told everyone what he was going to do. Suddenly, there was a crack of gunfire from behind. The militia was shooting at them.
"Contact rear! Contact rear!"
Gage shouted over the radio as he turned in his seat and began firing through the shattered rear window of their pickup.
"Don't slow down,"
Harvath ordered his team.
"Left, then second right."
Arriving at the left turn, everyone braced as Stalin pulled the wheel hard. The tires screamed as the heavy SUV spun around the corner.
"Push it, push it,"
Harvath urged, and Stalin gave the Land Cruiser even more gas. They had to be doing at least 80. Next to them, building facades whipped by. Then, an intersection. Had a car been passing through at the same time, it would have been a coffin-measuring festival. There was a blur of more buildings, and finally, the next road.
"Right turn! Right turn!"
he announced. Stalin applied the brakes, but only enough so as not to lose control in the turn. As soon as he was through it, he slammed the gas. Up ahead was their target, an Islamic cemetery.
"Get ready to jump," said Stalin.
Making sure his gear was secure, Harvath cracked open his door and then nodded. When they reached it, Stalin slammed on the brakes and yelled,
"Go! Go!"
Harvath hadn't even hit the ground before the Delta Force operative had once again put the pedal to the floor. Jumping from a moving vehicle, even one that had just slammed on its brakes, was an invitation for a serious injury. It became an engraved invitation when you did it in the dark. As he hit the ground, Harvath rolled and kept on rolling until all his momentum was dissipated. In Islam, the deceased are buried in a shroud and placed on their right side without a coffin,
facing the Kaaba in Mecca. A small grave marker is used, usually less than 12 inches high. Getting to his feet, he ran for the only cover available, a small row of date palms. But Harvath hadn't come to the cemetery to hide, at least not totally. He had come to take out the two technicals that were following his team. By the time he reached the trees, Haney had already raced by. Now came the gray pickup that was chasing him, with its heavy machine gun mounted in the back. A militia member with an AK-47 was leaning out the front passenger window, firing. He had no idea where the second technical was, but it had to be close. Without wasting any more time, Harvath ran for the other side of the cemetery. At the corner of the property was an intersection where three roads came together. It would give Stalin and Haney a greater opportunity to bring the technicals into his crosshairs. As Harvath ran, he hailed the drone team and told them to get the Reaper back over his location. Killing the Sparkle, they turned it around and set it on a heading for Zeltan. In the distance, Harvath could hear sporadic gunfire.
"Haney," he demanded over his radio. "Sit rep."
It took a moment for the Marine to reply.
"Three blocks out," he finally yelled. "Still taking fire."
Switching his attention to the other vehicle, he said,
"Stalin, sit rep."
"Four blocks away, no sign of—"
the Delta Force operative began. He was interrupted by Morrison.
"Contact left, contact left."
From their direction, Harvath could hear another barrage of gunfire. He broke into a sprint. At the edge of the cemetery was a rock the size of a dumpster. What its significance was, or what it was doing there, was beyond him. All he knew was that it had an unimpeded view of the intersection and provided a perfect place to set up shop. As he reached it, he relayed to the team that he was in place and ready for them to draw their tails into the kill zone.
"Coming in hot,"
Haney immediately replied.
"From the west."
"Roger that,"
Harvath answered, as he unfolded the grenade launcher's stock and flipped up its rear sight. Shouldering the weapon, he disengaged the safety and positioned himself against the rock.
30 seconds,
Haney said over the radio. Harvath took one last look around the area to make sure no one was sneaking up on him, and then made ready to fire.
"Bring it."
The sound of gunfire got louder as Haney and his pursuer got closer to the intersection. Soon enough, Harvath could see him flashing his high beams. The next thing he knew, Haney was in the middle of the intersection, and his truck had been sent into a spin. It was at that moment that time seemed to slow down. Chapter 31. It was called a bootleg turn. Dropping into second gear, Haney gave the wheel a quick jerk to the right and then spun the wheel all the way to the left. As Haney's vehicle fishtailed into a 180-degree turn, the men behind him had no idea what was going on. Gage, who had already inserted his third fresh magazine into his M4, opened up full auto on the cab of the other vehicle. The rounds punched holes through the sheet metal and shattered the rest of the glass. Both vehicles came to a stop, facing each other, 15 feet apart in the middle of the intersection.
"Any time, Harvath,"
Haney said over the radio. Throwing his vehicle in reverse, he began backing out of the intersection as fast as he could. Harvath's grenade launcher was loaded with high-explosive thermobaric rounds, which produced little to no shrapnel. Nevertheless, the minimum safe distance from detonation was 30 feet. As soon as Haney got to 25, Harvath warned,
"Going hot,"
pressed the trigger, and let it rip. The fuse on a thermobaric round armed itself 3 meters after leaving the launcher's muzzle. In this situation, there was plenty of time for it to arm before hitting its target. Except for one thing. Harvath's aim had been off. It wasn't like shooting a rifle. It was more like lofting a tennis ball the length of a long swimming pool and trying to land it in a wastebasket. The round sailed over the militia technical and detonated in front of a building on the other side of the intersection.
"Damn it,"
he cursed. Racking the weapon, he loaded another round and readjusted. Before he could press the trigger a second time, the driver of the militia vehicle had already popped the clutch and was squealing his tires. Harvath fired anyway. This round was on the money. It took off in a high arc from the cemetery and landed squarely in the bed of the militia technical. It exploded, hot and bright, melting the pickup truck's frame, killing all four people inside, and cooking off all of their ammunition. Over the radio, Harvath could hear Haney and Gage cheering. But nearby, he could also hear the sound of automatic weapons fire. Slinging the grenade launcher, he transitioned to his M4 and ran for Haney's technical. As he ran, he scanned for threats and hailed Stalin.
Tyler, give me a sit rep.
The Delta Force operative's transmission crackled in and out and came in pieces.
Vehicle inoperable. Four tangos. Returning fire. One prisoner KIA.
One prisoner KIA?
Fuck,
said Harvath, as he increased his speed. When he got to Haney's pickup, he didn't bother climbing into the cab. Leaping into the bed, he pounded on the side and yelled through the broken rear window.
Move! Move!
As Haney peeled out. Harvath had no intention of losing anyone from his team. He had to go in and pull them out before things got any worse. The Reaper pilot didn't need to tell him a swarm of militia members were already headed their way. He knew it just as surely as he knew the sun would soon be up. Too much had gone sideways. They needed to regain the initiative.
Corner! Yelled Haney. Hold on!
Harvath did as he was told. Haney hit the turn so hard, Harvath was almost thrown from the truck.
Where the hell are you guys?
Stalin yelled over the radio.
Inbound, hot,
Harvath replied.
Less than 60 seconds out, coming in east of your position. Hang in there.
All of a sudden, he heard thunder. Except he knew it wasn't thunder. The militia technical had opened up its powerful 50 caliber machine gun. Harvath didn't need to tell Haney to hurry. He'd heard it too. Dropping the hammer, he pushed the pickup as hard as it would go. 30 seconds later, Harvath pounded on the cab and yelled for Haney to stop. He had just caught a glimpse of the militia vehicle. Jumping out of the bed of the truck, he yanked open the rear door and grabbed the RPG launcher from the back seat. As he loaded a grenade, he hailed Stalin over the radio.
RPG incoming. Take cover. Now!
Running back to where he had seen the technical, he mounted the weapon, took a knee, and after checking his back blast area, sighted in his target. The flashes from the monster 50 cal machine gun as it spat its rounds looked like lightning.
Smoke check that motherfucker! Stalin shouted over the radio. If you don't, we're dead!
Harvath didn't wait. Pressing the trigger, he sent the 93mm single-stage heat warhead sizzling toward its target. The militia member firing the machine gun never saw it coming. The grenade hit the technical, and it exploded in an enormous fireball. Flaming pieces of wreckage littered the street, and a hail of razor-sharp shrapnel rained down as Harvath leapt back into Haney's truck.
Let's go,
he ordered. A block down, Haney turned to the left. There was still the sound of sporadic gunfire. He drove as close to it as he dared. Then Harvath and Gage hopped out and moved to the battle on foot. Locals peered out windows or stood in doorways to watch what was happening. When they saw the Americans, some retreated inside. Many simply stayed in place, as if rolling gunfights happened every day in their neighborhood. As they neared the corner, Harvath asked for one more sit rep. Stalin radioed that there were two militia members remaining and gave their location. They had gotten under the roof of a house. Every time Stalin and his team tried to move, the militia showered them with rounds. Harvath ordered him to sit tight. When he and Gage got to the corner, he radioed Stalin and then counted down from three. On cue, Stalin drew out the snipers. As soon as the militiamen popped up, Gage stepped out from around the corner and, with Harvath covering him, shot them both. But the moment Gage had gotten his rounds off, another sniper materialized in the window of a different building and fired.
The bullet entered the back of Gage's left shoulder.
Fuck!
He cursed, as Harvath grabbed him by his vest and yanked him back around the corner. Harvath radioed everyone that there was a third sniper and for Stalin and his team to stay put.
Where the hell did that guy come from?
Gage asked through gritted teeth.
Second-story window across the street,
Harvath replied. He hadn't seen the shooter until the flash had erupted from the end of his muzzle, and by then it was too late.
Can you still fight?
Gage nodded. Slinging his rifle, Harvath transitioned to the Russian grenade launcher and racked it, loading his last thermobaric round.
Just pin him down long enough for me to get off my shot.
$100 says you'll miss.
Harvath shook his head and then pointed forward, signaling that he was ready to go. Gage was in rough shape. He had trouble supporting his rifle with his left arm. It took him significant effort to raise it high enough. Finally, he signaled that he was ready. Together, the two men swung out into the street. Gage peppered the building's second-floor windows with rounds from his M4. Harvath brought the pump-action grenade launcher up, sighted in the window, and fired. The shot was perfect. It sailed right into the room where the sniper had been and detonated in a blinding explosion. Glass, timber, and pieces of concrete erupted out onto the street. A pillar of thick black smoke rose into the air.
Time to go,
Harvath said, as he transitioned back to his rifle, scanned for more threats, and began issuing orders over the radio. He was relieved to see Stalin, along with Barton and Morrison, moving Umar Ali Halim quickly down the street. It must have been the little Libyan, the one who had ratted them out back at the compound, who had gotten killed in the exchange of gunfire. Just beyond them, Harvath could make out their land cruiser riddled with bullet holes. The night sky was beginning to give way to morning. They needed to get moving. Haney quickly backed the technical down the street to pick everyone up. It was a double cab designed to hold 5 people, but that was going to be pushing it for a team of men in tactical gear. With 6 shooters plus a hostage, someone was going to have to ride in the back. Harvath and Barton both offered to do it. Once they had all been loaded, Haney peeled out and began speeding them out of town. As Stalin helped Gage pack his wound with hemostatic gauze up front, a call came for Harvath over the radio. It was the drone team. They had good news, but they also had bad news. The good news was that they were back overhead. The bad news was that an army of Libya Liberation Front members was headed right at them. Chapter 32.
How many, and from what direction?
Harvath replied.
There's a 3-vehicle convoy, including one technical west of you, out of Abu Kamash, the drone team leader stated. A 5-vehicle convoy is to your east from the port of Zawara with 2 technicals. Finally, there's a 7-vehicle convoy approaching from your south. That one has 4 technicals, 2 of which are mounted with anti-aircraft guns.
Shit. How far out are they?
The convoy from Abu Kamash is a little over 10 clicks out. The others are closer to 20.
That was way too close as far as Harvath was concerned. They'd never be able to outrun them. Not with the piece of shit truck they were driving, and definitely not when it was loaded down with 6 shooters, 2 of whom were riding in the bed, all their gear, plus a hostage.
I'll let you guys call it, but my preference is that you take out the Abu Kamash convoy first, said Harvath.
Negative. We're not authorized to target Libyan militias.
You've got to be kidding me. What do you mean you're not free to target Libyan militias?
Our agreement with the Tunisians is that airstrikes are only authorized when targeting Islamic militants.
Fucking politics.
Let me talk to your senior.
I am the senior. In fact, I specifically requested this op to make sure you guys got everything you needed.
I appreciate that, but what I need right now is some CAS,
Harvath replied, using the acronym for close air support.
Don't worry, the drone team leader replied. We're going to help navigate you out of this.
Harvath was worried.
What other armed assets do we have in the air that didn't launch from Tunisia?
He asked.
There's another Reaper west of Benghazi. but it launched from U.S. Naval Air Station Sigonella on Sicily.
So what? How quick can we get it on station here?
Per our agreement with the Italians, only non-Libyans can be targeted in drone strikes launched from Sigonella. The world had lost its mind.
The Tunisians and the Italians realize that the Libya Liberation Front is allied with Ansar al-Sharia, which in turn is linked to Al-Qaeda, right?
Sorry, sir. I don't make the rules.
Are there any U.S. Navy ships in the Mediterranean right now operating drones?
Yes, sir, but none that will be able to get an asset on station for you quickly enough.
Give me the name of the nearest vessel.
The drone team leader confirmed his information and then replied, "It's the Nimitz-class supercarrier, the USS George H.W. Bush." Now they were getting somewhere.
"Stand by,"
said Harvath, as he pulled out his satellite phone and dialed the cell phone of the Director of Central Intelligence. Back in the United States, it was just past 11 o'clock at night. Bob McGee answered on the third ring.
"Sorry to wake you," said Harvath. "I need you to make a phone call for me. Fast."
He gave the DCI the details and secured his promise to cut out the U.S. ambassador to Libya, as well as the defense attaché, even though that was protocol. They'd only get in the way. Within 60 seconds of hanging up, McGee had the Secretary of Defense on the phone. The SecDef personally called the commander of the 6th Fleet, who conferenced in the commander of Carrier Strike Group 2, which was responsible for the USS George H.W. Bush. Once they were all on the line, McGee explained the situation and what they needed. 5 minutes later, a phone rang at the Tunisian airbase from which the Reaper tracking Harvath and his team was being piloted. After authenticating the caller and listening to the Pentagon's instructions, the drone team commander replied, "Roger that, right away." Relaying the command to the drone pilot, he then turned to his Tunisian liaison and stated, "This drone is being removed from inventory and will not be returning to Tunisian soil. We're handing over control to the USS George H.W. Bush." Within seconds, the drone banked and headed out to sea. As it did, Harvath's satellite phone vibrated. It was McGee. "As soon as Strike Group 2 has control of the drone, video to the base in Tunisia will be cut. They know what's going on, but it gives them cover. Once the drone gets beyond Libya's territorial waters, they're off the hook."
"But that's 12 nautical miles," Harvath replied, as he stared out from the back of the technical, expecting to see militia members behind them at any moment. "We don't have that long."
"Strike Group 2 isn't going the full 12. The second the handoff is complete, they're sending it back to you. In the meantime, you've got to figure something out because you are on your own." Harvath acknowledged the director's update, made one more request, and then disconnected the call. They were approaching the north side of Zelten now. With every building they passed, he saw people in windows and on rooftops, most of them with cell phones. Not good. There was no question in his mind that the team's location and heading was being relayed back to the Libya Liberation Front. Harvath wasn't one for ducking a fight, but he was a big believer that discretion was always the better part of valor. Gage was already injured. He didn't want to risk more injuries, or worse if he didn't have to. If they could make it out of town and into the sparsely populated area between Zelten and the coast, they might be able to find a place to hole up and avoid the Libya Liberation Front altogether. But without the drone monitoring the militia's progress, there was no telling how much time they had. If they were going to pull off and hide, they'd have to do it soon. Getting on the radio, he relayed to the team what he wanted them to be on the lookout for. Minutes later, he could see Zelten receding. So far, there were no vehicles approaching. As the area's small farms grew farther and farther apart, Haney's voice came over the radio. Up ahead, he could see a small cluster of buildings surrounded by a low wall. Harvath told him to head for it. He had a feeling those buildings might be their best and only opportunity for survival. Chapter 33. Paris. Tursunov had eaten dinner in a small Moroccan restaurant near Notre Dame,
along the Rue Xavier. It had come recommended by Abdul and was close to the last stop he needed to make before turning in for the night. Walking up to the Pont Royal, he crossed the Seine and entered the enormous formal garden created by Catherine de' Medici, known as the Jardin des Tuileries. Rolling out like a giant green welcome mat that stretched from the Louvre Museum to the Place de la Concorde, it was one of the most popular places in all of Paris to gather, stroll, and relax. Statues by Giacometti, Maillol, and Rodin adorned the manicured grounds and crushed gravel walkways. It boasted two giant fountains, one of which, much like the cathedral in Santiago, had drawn his attention for a very special reason. Isis despised the French. They despised them for being the European embodiment of everything they saw was wrong with the West. The French were arrogant, libertine hypocrites who had outlawed all face covering, including niqabs and burqas. The French not only pretended to desire Western ideals like democracy, free speech, and human rights, but they actively sought to impose them on the Islamic world through force. If that required dropping bombs on and killing Muslim people, the French were more than happy to do it. ISIS had set its sights on France and was determined to attack it repeatedly. Tursunov had been told that they didn't care where he struck, as long as he was successful. He knew they preferred that he strike Paris. It was the heart of the nation, and any successful attack there had the added benefit of not only damaging the French psyche, but also killing plenty of Western tourists and thereby helping to damage the economy. Very few would want to visit a city, or a nation for that matter, besieged by terrorism. Paris presented the additional benefit of being awash with strangers. He could wander, he could linger, he could study the ebb and flow of people, he could take photographs. None of it would attract undue attention. That had been important when selecting the Tuileries for his attack. But just as important had been an added, personal piece of symbolism. His Sufi mother believed that symbolism was a reflection of the divine, and that numerology was one of its forms. The Holy Quran, when explored through the lens of numerology, contained incredible revelations. The atomic number for iron, Earth's ratio of land to sea, the genetic code of the bee. But one of its most fascinating revelations, made more than 1,000 years before it would happen, was the date of man's lunar landing. She had imbued in him a sense of awe, and most important, of respect for how Allah's hand guided all things. It was this awe and wonder that had brought him to Paris, and specifically to the Tuileries. Of the things he was most certain of, there was nothing greater than his certitude in the truth of his Muslim faith. His belief was consistently fortified by the wickedness and ignorance of the non-Muslim infidel. A prime example was their devotion to the idea that the number 666 was somehow evil. In their book, The Mark of the Beast was described as 666, or 666. But 666 was also the number of gold talents delivered to King Solomon in 1 year. Certainly, they didn't believe Solomon to be the beast. Yet, they never seemed to take their reasoning that far. They seemed content to accept 666 as evil and leave it at that. But the number wasn't evil. In fact, it was actually divine, and he considered it Allah's signature. There was a host of reasons why. The angle between the North Pole and the plane on which the Earth traveled around the Sun was 66.6 degrees. The Tropic of Cancer was 66.6 degrees from the North Pole. The Tropic of Capricorn was 66.6 degrees from the South Pole. The equator was 66.6 degrees from both the Arctic and Antarctic circles. The Earth's average orbital speed was 66,666 miles per hour. And as if he needed even more proof of Allah's design, the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, where the Prophet Muhammad ascended into heaven, was 666 miles from the Kaaba in Mecca. Allah's signature was everywhere, and he always strove to let it guide him. That was why he had chosen the Tuileries. Not only was it popular and packed with people, but its round fountain was exactly 666 miles from the center of the Cathedral of Santiago de Compostela in Spain. Allah had sent him a message. Reaching the fountain, he turned and looked to his east. Beyond the Place du Carrousel, he could see the Louvre's great glass pyramid. It was constructed of 666 rhombi and sat exactly 666 miles from the pilgrimage sanctuary of Lourdes. Turning to his west, he could see the Luxor obelisk, 666 meters away, at the Place de la Concorde. This was indeed willed by God. Walking around the fountain, he made his way toward the Rue de Rivoli and the Terrasse de Feuillon. Here, running for several blocks along the edge of the park, was the Fête des Tuileries. The Parisian carnival had bumper cars, giant slides, trampolines, climbing walls, carousels, shooting galleries, a Ferris wheel, ice cream, donuts, crepes, cotton candy, and even candy apples. It was popular with tourists and locals alike. Turzunov had visited on multiple occasions. He wanted to make sure he chose the absolute perfect moment. As he strolled through the crowded fairground, he smiled and whispered to himself,
"Allahu Akbar, God is the greatest."
Chapter 34. The next morning, Turzunov rose well before dawn and said his prayers. After a quick round of calisthenics, he showered, shaved, and put on a set of fresh clothes. Leaving the hotel, he passed by his café, but it was closed. He had to walk three more blocks before he found something that was open. He ordered several shots of espresso to go, doubled up on the paper cup, and grabbed a free weekly magazine on his way out the door. Outside, he lit his second cigarette as he headed toward the metro. Abdul's nephew, the chemist, lived in Aubervilliers, a predominantly French Arab suburb northeast of Paris. He wanted to ascertain for himself whether the young man was under surveillance. Abdul had provided him with Eunice's picture, address, and information about the mosque he attended. Under strict instruction, he did not let his nephew know that the man would be paying him a visit. Turzunov didn't want the chemist looking over his shoulder. If he were under surveillance, any unusual behavior would only heighten the suspicion of those who were watching him. Arriving in Aubervilliers, he exited the station and started walking. It was a town that had seen better days. The architecture at its center resembled that of any number of Parisian neighborhoods, but any similarity to the City of Light ended there. Aubervilliers was dark. Its inhabitants were rough. Its shops and restaurants, downmarket. The streets were dirty. Graffiti was everywhere. Surrounding the town were ugly concrete apartment complexes built in the 1960s and 70s. Here, as in many of the suburbs, Paris hit its poor, particularly its immigrants. Many of the immigrants were happy to have escaped the grinding poverty and hopelessness of their home countries. They had come in the same decades the ugly apartment complexes were built, grateful for the opportunity for a new life. They gladly accepted the jobs most French didn't want to take: street sweeping, sewer work, menial labor jobs. This wave of immigrants, the bulk of which came from Muslim North Africa, appreciated how much better things were for them and their families in France. They had hope for the future, not only for themselves, but even more so for their children. Liberté, égalité, fraternité wasn't just a motto, it was a promise. They believed that in France their children would experience more opportunity and achieve more than they could ever imagine. Their children wouldn't be Moroccans or Algerians. They would be free French men and women, with all of the benefits thereof. Unfortunately, that wasn't how things turned out. The immigrants' children found themselves with one foot in the old world and one in the new. Though born, raised, and educated in France, they were seen as outsiders and not fully welcome in French society. While some pushed for greater access, others retreated into ethnic pockets outside the city, marginalizing themselves and their voices. Without access to avenues of upward mobility, many angry young men turned to violence and criminal activity. Others turned to Islam. With more than 70% of its citizens followers of the faith, Aubervilliers was often referred to as a Muslim city. It also had a reputation for being dangerous. There were certain areas in town that even police officers wouldn't enter without substantial backup. Tursunov was wary of all these issues as he made his way to Yunus's mosque. Using a sophisticated system for surfing the web anonymously, he had studied Google Street View images of the area around the mosque. It had been set up on a busy road in an old retail space that looked to be a former beauty salon. Across the street was a small cafe. After familiarizing himself with the neighborhood, Tursunov entered the cafe and took a table near the window. It smelled like newspaper ink and dark roast coffee. Once he had ordered breakfast, he opened up the weekly he'd picked up earlier and pretended to read as he watched the comings and goings at the mosque. If French authorities were conducting surveillance, they were being very careful about it. Though there could have been cameras in any of the upper-floor apartments along the street, there was nothing overt. Every person who passed by looked as if he or she belonged in the neighborhood. None of them stood out. None of them screamed, "Cop!" Having served as both himself, he could usually spot military or law enforcement personnel the moment he saw them. There was something not only about their bearing, but also about their eyes. They were always moving, always taking everything in. It wasn't normal. Normal, everyday people were unobservant. Only those used to dealing with danger or those expecting trouble continuously swept their gaze from side to side. They were always searching for anything that seemed out of place or that might be a warning something bad was about to happen. It was a habit born of close calls and hard-won experience.